Hi, from Issaquah, Washington, this is Deepak Singh.
And from Cambridge, Massachusetts, this is Ari Jara.
And you're listening to The Coast.
The Coast.
Fire.
Podcast.
Hey, Hari, how are you today?
Very fine. All turkeyed out. I've been eating leftovers for 3 days straight now.
You and me both. I actually went and had Thanksgiving dinner at Jody's place, a mutual friend.
Oh.
So it was good fun. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. So what else is new?
Oh, well, I saw quite a few, bookmarks on the Delicious feed. And fortunately, I have gotten around to reading quite a few of them. And I think we have quite a lot of interesting things to talk about, right?
Yeah, I think so. And the funny part is that Tuesday evening, I think we'll be seeing each other.
Oh, you're going to be in Boston.
Yes, exactly.
Oh,
and hopefully I can get away. And I think I have like a post-workshop meeting with somebody, coffee, around like 5:30, 6. And after that, I'll be coming and harassing you. I don't think I've booked my hotel yet. So thanks for reminding me.
Oh, okay.
Of course, being Boston, that's not necessarily a problem. Because there's enough people to park with.
Yeah, and it's warm enough right now that you could probably sleep on the street.
I was actually going to ask you how warm do I need to dress?
No, it's actually pretty cold, but probably the same as Seattle, I would imagine.
I don't know about that. We haven't quite hit freezing yet.
Hey, speaking of good things that happened, we have our first vertical bar in the popularity column, I guess, on iTunes.
Woohoo!
Yeah, exactly. Woohoo, indeed. Thanks, guys, for listening in.
Yeah, so I guess there's a few of our relatives have started subscribing to the podcast.
Yes, that I'm sure helped too.
Yeah, anyway, so why don't we get started with the recording, and hopefully I won't have some of the issues I had when I switched off to look at pages yesterday. Getting your stream and my stream to line up was quite an exercise, and when I was re-listening to the podcast, I realized there were a few parts where I didn't do it properly, because I start talking while you're still talking, but most of the time I think I got it. So anyway, let's talk about our first story, and that comes up, I guess, was stemmed off by me bookmarking Rod Page's entry for the Elsevier Grand Challenge, the what they're calling knowledge enhancement in the life sciences. And the Elsevier Grand Challenge, have you had a chance to look at what it was?
Yeah,
and
actually,
what was all about?
Yeah, did you see the amazing video that they had on there with some scientists who had composed a song and so on? It was quite interesting.
Yep. Yeah, it's been around for a while. I think I heard about it first from, I think Rafael Sidi posted it up on FriendFeed and things like that. So that was the first time I heard about it, and I know a lot of the bio gang were interested in participating, and it looks like at least a couple of people made it to the semifinals. Rod Page and Lars Jensen, I think it's the Lars Jensen I know, both there, but Rod's entry is definitely very interesting.
So if I understand right, the Grand Challenge was Elsevier opened up its entire archive to the bioinformatics and general informatics community out there, and invited entries for what people would do with the data and submit proposals. Is that what the whole thing was?
And I've actually been remiss for not blogging about it, because I think it sort of speaks to the importance of open data and having data available to people to do things with it. And here's my guess. And my guess is that Elsevier is almost using this as a way to understand how people use data and potentially making APIs available. They might not open up everything like completely, but like the New York Times, they might start providing APIs.
Correct. Yeah. And I think this is a great step. It's a step in the absolutely the right direction. And I wonder how many entries they got. Is that open? Like, how many entries they got and how many finalists were picked and...
I'm not really sure. I think probably there's a Grand Challenge wiki out there, which sort of lists all the entries potentially. Yeah, I think no, it's the semi-finalist blogs and websites.
Right.
Blogs and wikis covering the challenge, which was covered in the BioGang wiki. I don't think it lists everyone.
Yeah. But there's, I guess, until they were accepting entries till July. And then there are, let's see, 9 semifinalists. And from the 9 semifinalists, they're going to pick one, I guess, and follow through and build the app. Or the 9 semifinalists actually build the application based on Elsevier's data, right? And that's the...
Yes, that I believe so. I mean, these are the ones that they selected to go into the next round. And, you know, obviously, I mean, the entries are pretty interesting. I mean, you have Sean Donahue and Lars Jensen who have their Reflect, which is automated annotation of scientific terms. So one I've spent time looking at, which is the Setting the Trees Free, which is, I love the title.
Yeah.
And Rod's done a great page for it also on iPhilo. It's like, almost like a Google code type setup where he's got a little video and the background and things like that. And even got Discuss comments integrated and done some, you know, mashups and so on and so forth.
Right.
Yeah. And for example, what you can do is that basically, I mean, here's an example of the kind of things that people are doing. So on Rod's thing, what he's basically, and he's released his proposal on Nature Proceedings. This is like a perfect example of, I think, where science is heading, you know?
Yeah.
So his project essentially takes a bunch of full text issues of molecular phylogenetics and evolution as the starting point. Then he extracts citation links to both papers and data. So GenBank sequences, specimens, along with geotags, because he's into biodiversity. And then basically he builds a web of objects which are linked by relationships. So it's a very semantic web kind of way of looking at things. And then so basically he treats each object equally and, you know, and essentially build a connection, build a graph using that. And so, you know, he's created a tool called bioguide.info, which he uses to resolve identifiers and return associated metadata. And the first thing I thought of when I saw this was that something like Parallax, which is a visualization system for Freebase, would be like perfect for visualizing this data.
I see. Yeah, I haven't really looked at Parallax.
Oh, it's really neat. You should definitely take it. It really tells you, it gives you really good insight into how structured data can be visualized.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's great. I love the page that Rod did. And just looking at some of the other entries, there's some really beautiful beautiful entries. I really like, would really want to dig into all of them and see what can be done. You know, see what people are doing.
And I thought just, I mean, I didn't go that much into what Rod Page had done, but I thought it was a very neat idea to open up your archives and just see the kind of applications that result. And I can't wait for other publishers to do the same thing as a test, you know, just because there's nothing better than eating your own dog food. And for the open source community, the open access community as well, right? We keep talking about how open data is going to be this, bring about this revolution in terms of, like, you know, data mining and the value that you can get from doing it. And there's nothing better than being given an opportunity to do it and kind of see the kind of applications that come out of it. Actually, I'm surprised how, I mean, I heard about it thanks to your bookmark, and I just wish that, you know, there was more kind of chatter about it everywhere, because this is the kind of stuff that really pushes the community into participating. And the more participation, I guess, we give, the better, the more chances are that you see more such APIs that you can use and exploit in the future, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's what, if you hung around Friend Feed, you'd have noticed.
Oh, okay. I guess I'm kind of a newbie on the Friend Feed circuit. But...
no, but definitely, yeah. I mean, but I do think that it generated enough, the fact that there's 9 high-quality semi-finalists, or at least, I mean, just glancing through, suggests that, you know, it is a good thing that they did. I really do think that they're going to open up APIs in the future.
Right.
And I think the New York Times is the best example. I think Elsevier has the kind of data in the scientific field that the Times has in, you know, general. You know, the Times has opened up its financial campaign finance data APIs and other APIs. And what we'll start seeing is Elsevier and Nature all releasing APIs of all this rich information that they have.
Right.
And then allowing people to sort of build applications and mashups on top of it. The challenge is going to be how they're going to monetize it. Because I think for them, it's sort of the future of the publishing business is around how can they monetize all this data that they are sort of collecting and what can be done with it in a reasonable way. So it'll be interesting. You know, maybe they'll have some limits as to how many calls you can make. And if you make calls beyond that, you have to pay a subscription fee. I don't know how it's going to work out, but I think this is very innovative of them. I've given Elsevier a very hard time over the years, and you know, I do think there's some well-meaning people in there. Definitely Raphael's the first person I can think of.
Speaking of monetizing these APIs, isn't most of the data that they're serving up anyway, I mean, almost in the open, and therefore, it makes...
It depends on how they... what data. I mean, they have, it's, you know, Elsevier has Scopus and Cyrus, and it's more to how they make the data available
right.
as to having the... Yeah. I don't know. I don't know where this is all going to go, but it's definitely an interesting exercise, and it looks like they've been fairly successful in getting participation and some pretty creative stuff. I mean, I think it just speaks to some of the concept of you bring, make the data available and people will do stuff with it.
Right. Yeah, it's some very cool submissions. I did look through some of the links and they're really, I guess the results come out soon, so it'll be a good time to check it out.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely looking forward to spending more time digging into some of the other entries for sure.
Cool. So the second link I saw that you'd bookmarked was a really good site called Embrace, right? The Embrace Grid, right?
Yeah, I heard about it first when there's a blog called The Programmable Web, run by John Musser. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce his name. I actually get to meet him next week, which is going to be cool. He has a list. He basically tracks APIs and web services. And he has a bunch of biomedical APIs listed, and there's not that many of them. And so I sort of posted that onto, I think I wrote a blog post about it saying, hey, there's a bunch missing here. We should probably let him know which ones these are. And either Pierre or Egon pointed me to Embrace, the Embrace Service Registry, which is essentially a registry for a bunch of web services. And I guess it started off as a sort of a European, pan-European effort to track the Embrace project, essentially, is a pan-European effort to do things like this. Maybe the EBI and people like that are involved. But it's great. And it came back into the radar yesterday because I started collecting a list of web apps, web services in the life sciences on my wiki. And I was looking around and I said, hey, you know, let me know about more of them. And immediately a bunch of people said, you want to look at Embrace immediately. So... it's great. You know, it's sort of a service registry environment, which I think is really needed because we have so many services, most of which don't work, but many do.
Right.
And many are useful. I mean, the Ensemble and EBI alone have so many of them.
Right. And I guess I looking at this, what I like is they have this, you know, whole feel about the question that they're trying to answer is how can, you know, everyday biologists and biological researchers combine all the data? You know, you have all these data streams coming in. And as we've talked about before on the podcast, I guess combining these workflows or coming up with these workflows is going to be the big kind of challenge for people. And they also talk of, you know, basically that's the question they're trying to answer, right? How can you combine all this data? And they have the BioSapiens project. What's that exactly about?
Yeah, I you actually pointed to that, and I didn't really know about it. But so it looks like it's a network. So it's, you know, the European Union has had these framework programs for a while where they try and bring together networks of researchers. Now, I don't know how well they work in practice, perhaps they do. I mean, some of our European colleagues will be probably best positioned to answer that. But basically, they want to have an effort to annotate genome data sets by laboratories around Europe, using, you know, a bunch of tools. And I think here is where these kind of distributed APIs really work out. You know, for example, you could have, and this is the context in which Embrace came back into the picture, you could have a service that sort of lets you know if a sequence that you have has, what do you call it? There's a new structure that's been published that matches a sequence that you've put, you know, submitted to a registry. And immediately you can have another API which tells you if there's a function associated with that sequence based on the structure, or, you know, a bunch of APIs that sort of can be connected to build a whole story rather than having everything in one site or doing it at your end, but rather using these public-facing APIs. So I think that's where Embrace really comes in. And it looks like BioSapiens sort of falls into that.
Yeah, I guess BioSapiens is like group annotation, right? Where a whole bunch of labs and people and, you know, get together and figure out how to annotate these sequences.
Professional crowdsourcing.
Right. Did you see, there was a really nice article in PLOS Biology, the title of which really caught my attention. It was Metagenome Annotation Using a Distributed Grid of Undergraduate Students. It was a
Sandra Porter blogged about it. That's how I heard about it.
Okay, yeah, I saw it, and it's from Carl Herman's group at the, where is this? Somewhere in France. Well, it'll be in the show notes. But yeah, it was a really nice paper which talked about using data from, I guess in this case, it was the, what was it, the Sargasso Sea database, Craig Benter's yacht, which sailed around and collected metagenomic sequences.
The Sorcerer
2. Yeah, Sorcerer 2, right. So,
yeah, there's a project in Cal IT2 in UCSD, the camera project, I think, which is also working on sort of making some of that data available or trying to figure out how to annotate a lot of those genomes.
So what this paper talks about is using that data to teach bioinformatics. And he has a very nice approach, and they've built a whole web front end that integrates with launching searches, which query, you know, so each student in the class, I guess, is given three sequences from this data set. And they have a workflow set up for them, and as they follow through the workflow, they learn a lot about like BLAST and, you know, homology hunting and phylogeny and so on.
Oh, that's cool.
And at the end of the whole thing, they actually come up with annotations. Now, of course, they're supervised by the faculty running the course, but all of the work is done by the undergrads, and I guess they've annotated megabytes of data using this. And importantly, when they queried their students to see how much they learned at the end of this whole live example, I mean, the students working with actual data and their annotations were kind of making a difference. I think they'll eventually end up being integrated with whatever database. But the students said that nothing worked better than actually doing this on data that, you know, a Google search wouldn't tell them what these genes did. They actually had to do it. And it was a very neat example on, as you said, crowdsourcing to bring about these annotations and especially using it to educate. And it was a very cool study.
Yeah, I'm actually more interested in the education part. I mean, when you want to learn how to program, I think what most people will tell you is just do something, do a real project.
Right, exactly.
You know, solve a problem. And I think we tend to forget that a lot in educating people with things like informatics and science. There's a lot of real data out there.
Right.
We should just make people solve real problems, and it's the best way to learn.
Yeah, exactly. Like, speaking for myself, I've been trying to teach myself some crystallographic routines, and I was very glad that the CCB4 community has released quite a lot of test data out there. And it would be nice to have, you know, kind of a repository of such test data sets. I mean, for the sequences, sequencing space, I mean, all of it is public, but for other kinds of data, you know, there's not that many public repositories that you can use to teach yourself some skill or the other.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key is having sort of these core data sets available somewhere where people can always get access to it. You know, for example, the OpenAI people have these sample data sets for evaluating docking programs. It's a great way for people to build docking programs as well, because that's a great resource of real data that they can use to benchmark their algorithms against and sort of test out their code and see if it's working properly. Things like that. I think you'll see more and more of that. I mean, it's been happening in the protein structure prediction community. They've always had these sort of reference sets, reference data sets that they've, you know, PDB-40, PDB-20, things like that forever. And I think it works pretty well.
Very cool. Well,
yep.
What is the next thing we were going to talk about?
That's my rant.
I think this has been great. You know, I mean, the whole opening up of APIs from Elsevier and, you know, all this stuff is just fascinating. I just wish, you know, sometimes I wish that people, like, whenever I go to some of these sites, like Elsevier's site was cool. You had this video which made its point really quickly. But, you know, when you have like something like Embrace, it would be really awesome if they had, you know, some incorporation of video or something in there to quickly get the point across, because there's nothing more powerful than knowing what something's about, like in the first few minutes of visiting it, especially if you're not from the field.
And, yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. Now that I'm not in science full time and I meet scientists, I've become very aware of the fact that scientists take a long time to get to their point.
Well, that's the advantage of being in marketing, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I've had a few meetings where it's like, okay, I know what you want to say. You know what you want to say. Why don't you just say it?
Just come out and say it, right?
Instead of giving me the backstory and, right, you know, the related story. It doesn't happen often, but I think it's a general. And when I go to conferences and I hear scientific talks, I definitely feel it more, you know, now that having heard some of these people who really know how to make a point, make it quickly and effectively. And, you know, and you can make out the PIs who are good at making their point quickly are the ones who are successful, I think, in the long term, because they just get things done. talking of being out of science and you are in science, you're still postdocing. This whole chief architect at Genome Commons at UC Berkeley was an interesting thread that happened. So Attila posted this job position, which, if you read it right, did you read the job description at all?
I didn't read any. Yeah, I read what's on the friend feed page.
Yeah, so I'll quickly read the job description. It's for the chief architect at Genome Commons. I've heard they might change the job title. So when you hear chief architect of Genome Commons and you read the... So it's working with the Brenner Research Group. So they're basically looking for someone who must be committed to open access, open source, savvy in mastering medical, legal, and sociological influences in the project. It'll require keen scientific acumen, need an understanding of human genetics, as well as outstanding software architecture and development skills. Fine. Yeah. And the salary that they offer is $48,000 to $55,000. And I basically fell out of my chair. And as I said in the on the friend feed thread, I mean, that's almost insulting.
That's almost what a postdoc makes at him. So
yeah, but
yeah, I know. But the correct. Go ahead.
You know, my point is, call it that then. Call it a research assistant.
Yeah,
software. Exactly. Yeah, don't call it chief architect. Right. Eric Jane had a great funny post on it. He says the reason is that in Seattle we still don't have the what was the word that he
name
used?
Name inflation or something like that, right?
Yeah, he called it. We don't have job title inflation in Seattle the way we have in the Bay Area. And if you're offering that kind of salary, it is significant job title inflation. But it also speaks to a second point. If people are serious about building software architectures in academia, you need people who understand software architecture. Being a chief software architect is not a trivial job. It requires tons of experience. You should have had experience in building systems. There's not that many people who build software systems. And I think you're sending the wrong message in some ways. You know, maybe based on what their expectations are, the salary is just fine. And based on some of the comments that Steve Brenner communicated through Attila, maybe that's what it is. But, you know, I was just flummoxed. I'm reading the job description. I'm like, ooh, cool position. And then I get there. I'm like, you're kidding me.
You know, going through all the posts all the posts in this thread, I do agree somewhat with what Steve Brenner says. And what he says is, and this is something you'll hear time and time again in the academic area, is that the privilege of getting to work on something this groundbreaking is kind of, you know, or the amount of responsibility and joy is payment enough. And, well, I'll just finish, but... And Bill Hooker actually had a very cool bunch of points in that it's hard to pay somebody a lot of money and then bring them in and then have them work with, you know, developers or whoever who you're not paying as much. So you might get like top-notch talent by paying them, you know, what industry pays them. But once they come in, their hands are kind of tied behind their back because You spent all your money getting that big person in, and then he's...
No, it's not even big person. So here's my point. They're not even paying academic software engineer salaries.
Right, right. That is pretty sad. Right.
They're paying postdoc salaries. No, that's a separate thread that we can have forever and ever, which is why a postdoc, which is one reason I refused in the end, didn't want to go into, didn't want to stay in academia. But call it a postdoctoral position, because you're not even paying academic software engineer salaries, and I happen to know roughly what those are. I think Bill has good points. I also think, but by saying, the honor of working here should make you happy, we often are overselling or thinking too much about our own projects. Now, I happen to think Genome Commons is really cool.
Right.
But, take some of the other projects. So the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratories has this new joint energy center that Oindrula is actually part of.
Mm-hmm.
Those guys are paying industry level salaries to everybody.
But I mean, the Berkeley, all the DOE labs are notorious for, having salaries way in excess of any university out there, be it the UC system or, the...
Yeah, I just think you are losing people to science, because paying somebody $55,000 and not calling it a post, they don't want a PhD, they want a software architect.
Right, exactly.
Right, they don't, I get the point, but I also think that we are hurting ourselves by not understanding the value of people, by expecting people to work just for the glory and of it all. At some point, it's going to hurt you. I think already is.
And right? That's what Steve Brannan said. At some point, that person just kind of packs his bags and leaves and goes to industry, because there's only that much you can do when you get paid that little.
It is. If you are treating it as an opportunity for somebody to learn, that's one thing. The way the job's described and the way it's titled does not read like that to me. So,
yeah. What is, I guess the nice thing about this whole exchange was, as you go further down the list, Steve Brannan actually comes back saying that they've revised the job description, and I guess they've submitted a proposal to increase the salary or something. So I guess FriendFeed has actually helped renegotiate the salary for...
So whoever gets a job, and if they get more money, I should get a cut for ranting about...
Right, right, exactly. You can send your check to deepak@deepaksingh.net.
I'm cheap. One latte will do.
Perfect.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was it. The other thing I sort of had put up there was... a bookmark on Sproutcore, and I think I sent you one on Cappuccino as well, cappuccino.org.
Right.
I actually bookmarked these because I was listening to a conversation the other day, on the Gilmore Gang. As anybody who knows me discuss Steve Gilmore will probably know that I think he's a complete self-absorbed, self-important, you know what. But he gets interesting guests on his show who have interesting opinions. So I do listen to it for that reason every now and then, depending on who the guest is. And Chris Messina, Brett Taylor, every time he has them, it's always fun to listen to the show. And what Chris said, they were talking about Flash and Silverlight and so on and so forth. And Chris was talking about, they were talking about rich internet applications and sort of as more and more people want to get into the browser, you're expecting richer and richer user interfaces in the browser. So obviously, so far, that's been done mostly through Flex and Flash. Microsoft is pushing Silverlight for the .NET Microsoft community. But what's also happened at the same time over the last sort of 6 months is these very rich JavaScript frameworks that have come up. The two that I can think of are Sproutcore and Cappuccino. I actually heard about Cappuccino first because... of this website called 280 Slides, which gives you a keynote type environment inside a browser. So it's beautifully done. You should check it out. And the Cappuccino people actually developed this JavaScript framework called Objective-J, because it's sort of modeled after Objective-C on the Mac. Mm-hmm. And the other one is Sproutcore, which I heard about from Matt Wood, I think on a tweet, and I think, I forget which Apple page uses Sproutcore I think their movie page or one of their pages, which has a very rich interface,
mm-hmm.
uses Sproutcore as its as its JavaScript library, and you get a very, very rich experience. So I guess the point I'm trying to make, talking about like a scientist and not getting to my point, is that I think what you're going to see is this innovation in the need to keep the web open and stick to open standards as opposed to Flash and Silverlight, which are very opaque, is you'll start seeing these JavaScript type libraries that are going to come up, which are doing a phenomenal job. I mean, you thought jQuery was cool, and then you look at these, and
actually,
you're like,
that,
oh,
that
wow.
Brings up an interesting a question I had. So I've looked at like jQuery, UE, you know, Dojo.
Yeah.
And I guess they're very powerful libraries, but this seems like the next step, right? The evolution from having extremely powerful kind of, you know, widgets and buttons and events and drag and drop and all that into the next big thing, right? Where you have like a, I guess, some higher level. Is that what these Cappuccino and Spark Core are doing, or are they kind of just like Dojo and all these other?
No, I think you are right. I think jQuery and Dojo and YUI are great for adding features to web pages. The goal of Sprout Core and Cappuccino is to build rich environments in a browser. Slightly different way of looking at it.
Right.
It's not to just do a good job of adding buttons and sliders. It's actually, how can I give you a desktop-like...
toolkit, I guess, right?
Toolkit to start building stuff. So if you look at some of the demos Sprout Core people has, I think they have like photo sample controls. I'm trying to catch, obviously 280 slides is the best example, of this whole thing.
Well,
because
actually, if you look at, have you ever used Yahoo Mail, for example?
Yeah.
I mean, that's done entirely using YUI or UE.
Yeah.
And it's very impressive. I mean, anybody uses Gmail too, right? But
Gmail probably uses some JavaScript library as well.
And actually, you know what? I'm glad you bookmarked this, because every time I've tried to use any of the electronic notebook, I've not tried that many, but every time I've tried to use an ELN out there, I just hope and pray that like all the richness of JavaScript that you're seeing on, say, you know, all these applications catches up with those ELNs. Like, I would love to have drag and drop. I would love to have live charting. I would love to have all these things integrated into an electronic library notebook. And with these very free and open, rich, you know, JavaScript frameworks, I can't wait for a good, kind of application to, a project to start up, which brings an open ELN based on all these very powerful presentation technologies to, you know, mash it all up together and give me an ELN. That'll be something that, you know, I can't wait to see.
So I know where Apple was using Sprout Core. Mobile Me uses Sprout Core, and if you've looked at the .Mac web gallery, that's all Sprout Core as well.
I see.
So, yeah, so, you know, and of course, I think 280 slides are still the best example, but these are really, really rich interfaces. The .Mac web gallery essentially looks like iPhoto. It feels like iPhoto.
Mm-hmm.
It works like iPhoto. You're obviously getting all these all these very rich environments, and I think this is just a start, right?
Right.
Or you're going to get even richer and richer and richer features over time.
Yeah, I've just started playing around with JavaScript charting. Let's see, if I actually get my act together, I'll put up a screencast or something on my site.
Yeah. So, definitely they're not meant for every situation, because you don't always want desktop-like features. Sometimes all you need is a web page with some simple JavaScript. So, but I think you're going to get client-side development going sort of to the next level on the web. With, you have your YUIs and the jQueries and the Dojos of the world, and then you'll have sort of at the level above that, the Sprout Cores and the Cappuccinos.
Right.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Very cool. And we are right at our 35-minute mark, too. So was there anything else you wanted to cover today?
Well, I think that's a good point to end the show. And I guess we're really thrilled that we are at that one, vertical bar in the iTunes list. And
yes.
And
yeah, we still need to figure out some of the funny things that are happening with iTunes with respect to the length of the songs, the pieces. I just can't figure out why it's happening. And definitely the only data point I have is the time you did it at your end.
Right.
As opposed to the way I've been doing it, going from WAV to MP3 in iTunes, it shows up just fine. The other thing that needs to be figured out is that image. I don't know what's happening
there
as well.
Our image keeps getting squished and squashed.
Squished, even though we use the standard size recommendations. So probably need to go into some forums and ask people what the hell's happening or email the iTunes people.
So if anybody knows how to fix the image size that we see in iTunes, please do drop us a
note. And let us know if on a Mac, why your podcast would show as 1 minute and 1 second all the time, even though when you play them, they're the full length, and when you download them, they're okay. But on iTunes, they show 1 minute and 1 second every time, no exceptions. I just don't know why. Anyhows, that's it. I'll see you in a couple of days.
Yeah, same here. And yeah, let's just remind everybody that they want to suggest stories for us to talk about. We would love for you to do it by, what's it, 4:C?
4:C2C bio. So C, letter 2, C, bio on Delicious.
Perfect. All right, so here, signing off from Cambridge. This is Hari, and
this is Deepak from Issaquah. Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Bye.